Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, Governor Tony Evers unveils a $2.4 billion capital budget, with nearly half of that spending going to the University of Wisconsin system. But top Republicans signaled they'd whittle down what they called a wish list of projects. GOP lawmakers have released a slate of bills to overhaul the state's absentee voting practices, and Wisconsin's COVID-19 vaccine supply is increasing as officials prepare to open 4 more vaccination clinics. Rewind, your week in review for February 26th.
I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This week, Governor Tony Evers unveiled his nearly $2.4 billion capital budget, which contains projects that would impact 31 of the state's 72 counties, according to his office. Accounting for nearly half of that total spending is $1 billion earmarked for the University of Wisconsin system. That includes $150 million for a new engineering building at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Another top project is $164 million for a new state office building in Milwaukee. That's something that Governor Evers sought to greenlight 2 years ago, but wasn't able to get it done. Overall, this capital budget would be covered through nearly $2 billion in new borrowing, another $86 million in existing borrowing, and $340 million in cash, gifts, and other revenue sources. JR, what stuck out to you in this framework, and how have Republicans responded so far?
Well, remember, 2 years ago, Evers started with about a $2.5 billion capital budget. Republicans pared that back to roughly $1.8 billion. What's interesting to note is, remember, in the last two budgets that former Governor Scott Walker did, he really pared back on vertical spending, essentially, you know, building buildings, borrowing to these kind of construction projects. So 2 years ago, the justification was that there was a quote-unquote thirst, a need to reinvest in state buildings and get back on track. This one is not that much smaller than 2 years ago. The argument from Joel Brennan, the DOA secretary, when I talked to him this week, was that there still needs to be an investment in state buildings. What's more, they need to invest in what the future looks like, which is why you're seeing on the University of Wisconsin system campuses investments in science and technology buildings, an engineering building at UW-Madison. So that's kind of how they're trying to pitch this. The state office building would bring together all these state agencies under one roof and try and be a place to provide services looking forward for Wisconsin. Talking to Republicans, the co-chairs of the Finance Committee, Mark Bourne, a Republican from Beaver Dam, said the state will invest in priorities, but pretty much strongly hinted that this is not going to be a $2.5 billion capital budget when it's all said and done. Howard Markline, other co-chair, a senator from Spring Green, called it a wish list. What I'm kind of watching for is how this process plays out. Remember, 2 years ago, after Evers proposed a capital budget, it goes to the Building Commission. The first time that I have ever seen, the Building Commission deadlocked on the proposal period. It's kind of usually a formality of getting this thing kind of advanced through the budget process. So how does it kind of the first impression we get out of this reception will be before the Building Commission again? And then what do Republicans take out? You know, don't forget, it's not all about Milwaukee and Madison. Granted, there's money in there for a new museum in Milwaukee. There's money in there for moving the Historical Society to a new plot of land downtown Madison. But there's also projects for River Falls. That's in a Republican district. So you're going to have to watch and see how Republicans look at this, because there are investments being proposed in their backyards that may be hard to turn down.
Right, and it's worth noting that the State Building Commission is planning on meeting March 17th, and then it gets kicked to the Joint Finance Committee, so we'll keep an eye on those proceedings from there. I want to move on now to a topic that we didn't really have a chance to talk about last week. As of today, Governor Tony Evers has signed 6 bills into law, including one that would get the ball rolling on overhauling the state's approach to unemployment insurance. Evers first proposed the legislation as part of a special session call and State of the State address last month, but Republicans at the time sort of ignored it. Last week, though, they came back with a substitute amendment that strips $5.3 million in funding that Evers had sought to begin this overhaul. Instead, the language directs the Department of Workforce Development to, quote, seek and exhaust any federal funding available to begin modernizing the system. couple other things that amendment did, it added liability protections in for businesses and others related to COVID-19 claims, and it again waived the one-week waiting period for individuals who have been laid off to seek unemployment benefits. The suspension expired earlier this month after Evers voted a different COVID bill that Republicans sent to him. Jarrett, what stood out to you in this bill, and can you talk more about the unemployment provisions?
It was a vehicle to get something done. So remember, the governor proposed a special session bill that just focused on the $5.3 million he wanted to get the ball rolling of this computer overhaul. Republicans, though, unhappy that he vetoed that COVID-19 bill that they had put a bunch of conservative priorities in, saw this as a vehicle to get the ball rolling on some things they wanted, particularly the liability protections. Remember, that provision was a part of a deal that Evers has struck with Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu, a Republican from Oostburg, to do kind of a quote-unquote clean COVID bill with that one provision. In exchange, they were going to strip out things like banning mandatory vaccines, stripping local and state officials the power to restrict meetings at houses of worship during the pandemic. So that liability protection was a big deal for Republicans and was kind of a give by Evers for that COVID bill. They found a way to bring it back through this unemployment bill. What I'm watching going forward are, one, a big provision of this was reinstituting the suspension of the one-week waiting period for unemployment. Republicans put that in place a decade ago. Under the Federal CARES Act bill, to qualify for the enhanced federal funding, you have to have a suspension of that one-week waiting period. They suspended it back in April of last year as part of the bill that passed on a bipartisan basis from both houses, signed by Governor Evers. That ended February 7th. Now, because Republicans waited to get that bill on the floor last spring, the state lost out on $25 million. It tried to make the bill retroactive and recoup that money. Didn't work. What I'm watching this time is the suspension ended February 7th on that April bill. It's back in place through mid-March. One, they again tried to make it retroactive. From what the Department of Workforce Development told me, the people who got laid off post-February 7th will definitely get the 1 week extra of unemployment benefits. They just have to reprogram the computers to do it, which is proven to be a challenge at times with the unemployment system in Wisconsin, but they will get that 1 week. The question is, will the Department of Labor now approve making that enhanced federal aid retroactive? It's about $1.3 million a week. So we're talking 3 weeks possibly of missed federal aid, $3.9 million. Will that happen? The second thing is, this extension runs through mid-March. Why that's important is the new COVID-19 bill being debated by Congress right now would extend that enhanced federal money. It means, from what I've told by the Fiscal Bureau, we would likely have to go through this debate all over again about suspending the 1 week delay. Will that become a vehicle then, if the state chooses to do that, to get more COVID stuff done? Assembly Speaker Robin Voss this week said that Republicans were looking at bringing back an omnibus COVID package. Now, their priorities are things that Governor Evers didn't like in the first one, right? Again, the mandatory vaccine stuff, limits on places of worship, giving lawmakers oversight of federal aid in the pandemic. We were in line through this new COVID bill for potentially for hundreds of millions more. So they want to say in how that money is spent. Might they use that extension as a part of a package to put back on Evers' desk to give them a say in how the money is used or accomplish these other priorities? That's something to watch in the next few weeks as the debate about the federal bill plays out.
Thanks for that preview. Okay, now let's hear from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Democratic Representative Evan Goyke, who spoke about the bill on the floor, and then we'll hear from Governor Tony Evers, who signed it into law on Thursday.
Fires the secretary. People don't answer the phone. Can't get the checks out the door. And who does he blame? The legislature. Because somehow it's our fault that he hired the wrong secretary and they can't do their gall darn job. So Governor Evers, if you need us to be here today to force you to go and do something, that's why we're doing it. We had hoped that there was a way for us to work together over the past 6 to 8 months to say, let's do this. But calling our sincere offer to work together a political stunt, saying that the job that you were doing is great, saying that you don't need any help from the legislature because you have the ability to solve it yourself and you never do? Well, that's what's embarrassing.
840 days ago, Democrat Tony Evers defeated Republican Scott Walker. It's taken me that long to figure out how business operates in this building with divided government. And you can really feel it in the speaker's speech. The governor leads, Republicans follow. The governor leads, Republicans sue him. The governor leads, the Republicans what, go into special session for 12 seconds, come back with their own plan. Water it down, water it down. Hurry up, Governor Evers, solve the UI system, and then wait, you're going too fast. This amendment includes the funding needed to fix the system today, and that's what we should do.
Now, it's unfortunate that the legislature chose to cut the funding we'd asked for to commit to upgrading our system from start to finish, because I want to be clear, this bill won't be enough to solve the problem. But after a decade of failing to act, I'm proud my special session could finally prompt the legislature to do something on this issue. And I'm proud this bill is passed with bipartisan support, because we can't wait another minute to get to work. So today, we're going to take the first step towards ensuring something like this never happens to the people of Wisconsin again.
Republican Senators Dewey Strobel and Alberta Darling have unveiled 10 bills surrounding absentee voting practices in Wisconsin. The package includes bills that would limit drop boxes to one per municipality, ban clerks from filling in missing absentee information on absentee ballot envelopes, impose additional ID requirements for absentee ballots, and curb the use of the indefinitely confined designation. Republicans have also launched an audit of Wisconsin's elections to be conducted by the nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau that was approved a couple weeks ago, but will take a few months to complete. Those efforts came after the state saw a big jump in absentee balloting in the last round of elections last year, tied to the COVID-19 pandemic. And the bills we're seeing this week are targeting some of the same practices that former President Donald Trump and his allies targeted in lawsuits challenging the legality and the results of Wisconsin's elections. The bill's authors say these measures are necessary to help restore trust in the state's electoral system. Former President Trump himself did perpetuate many of those unfounded claims about widespread voter fraud in the first place. Democrats, meanwhile, have called these bills anti-voter and urged lawmakers to withdraw them. Jared, do you expect to see more of this kind of legislation from Republicans as the session continues?
Likely, and the bottom line is none of it's going to sign into law. Look, Republicans have had some complaints about the November election, and I get the impression, talk to people, there's a legitimate conversation to be had about has the Elections Commission exceeded its authority in telling clerks they can fill in the missing information on an absentee ballot envelope. You know, that's a legitimate question to have. How has state law really addressed drop boxes? You know, some people argue that's not really clear. Totally legitimate question. There is, however, no widespread conspiracy against Donald Trump. There's been no evidence or proof of machines changing votes for Donald Trump. You are seeing kind of a reflection of a thirst by the Republican base, however, to see something done, because if you look at polls, majority of Republicans are convinced that the election was quote-unquote stolen from Donald Trump. Now, it probably is because Trump kept telling him that the election was rigged and it was stolen from him. That said, so there are some legitimate questions to be asked about how the elections have been conducted. What I'm watching for in this is, A, do they keep it all in a separate bill, or do they put it all in one big package? B, do they try and do something they could get done and help with the crush of absentee ballots? Because there is some discussion, I think there could be some consensus among Republicans and Democrats about a bill that allow clerks to begin processing absentee ballots before the day of the election. Actually, Governor Evers' budget bill includes a similar provision about that. He also, in his budget bill, seeks to expand various things with voting. So you can tell right away where the demarcation lines are in this debate between these bills and what Evers has proposed. It also, I think, lays down a marker of if Republicans were to win back the governor's office in 2022, where they might go with these election laws, things they might try to do. So there's that to watch. I just want to also address, I give it like indefinitely confined status. You know, there was a huge rush of people claiming that status because we had a huge rush of absentee ballots. In 2022, if we're back to quote unquote normal in a post-pandemic world and people are voting more in person, you might see that die down. If Republicans win in 22, might it kind of take away the passion to do these bills? Maybe. If we get farther away from the 2020 election, might it kind of lower the temperature in this debate? Possibly. But I do get the impression that Republicans, A, feel like the Elections Commission has gone too far and they want to rein it in, and that, B, there are things like the indefinitely confined status that they think are ripe for abuse. Now, there was nothing in the various lawsuits I covered filed by President Trump and supporters that prevented hard proof the court accepted about definitely confined voters abusing that. But you can see their concern that, you know, maybe there's something looked at about how it's being used, and if it was, it's reflecting the intention, which is morally for people who are infirmed, confined to the health, and those kinds of things.
Right, and we'll see more when the Assembly Elections Committee decides to meet. I believe they had a meeting scheduled for this week that they ended up canceling, but they should be convening again sometime next month. The other thing I want to note is probably following that Legislative Audit Bureau audit, we might see some more targeted bills from Republicans at that point. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss was asked about these bills, and he said he expressed some concerns about certain provisions, but he didn't really elaborate on those details.
Yeah, I think part of it was the bills weren't really run by him before they were released, so his leadership didn't have a say in what was being put out. Some of his members signed on to those bills that were circulated, but I'm watching to see, again, is there a big package to do it all in one shot? Will it be individual bills? That'll kind of all play out here in the next couple months.
Yep, moving on to our next topic. U.S. Senator Ron Johnson faced backlash this week following his comments in a joint congressional hearing with former U.S. Capitol security officers about the January 6th riot in D.C. During the hearing, Johnson read from a column in the conservative Federalist magazine claiming, quote, fake Trump protesters and provocateurs, as well as police themselves, were to blame for violence at the Capitol last month, which left five people dead. The Washington Post has reported that many of the over 200 rioters who are facing criminal charges have self-identified as Trump supporters or have ties to right-wing extremist groups. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, who presided over the hearing, said afterwards that Johnson, quote, seems to be in denial and somehow wants to blame everyone but President Trump for inciting this. That's according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. That hearing came after the Senate earlier this month voted to acquit former President Trump on a charge that he incited the January 6th insurrection. In the days after, Johnson downplayed the violence at the Capitol and said, quote, this didn't seem like an armed insurrection to me. Chair, what do you make of Johnson's comments this week?
Well, in asking people about this, they noted to me that, one, Ron Johnson has very much aligned himself with President Trump. Ron Johnson has rejected any suggestion that the Republican Party should distance itself from the former president. He also kind of went after Mitch McConnell last week with comments the GOP Senate leader made about President Trump. So Ron Johnson and President Trump are really in the same lane a lot of things, and Johnson is in some ways defending the president and his supporters. Two, Johnson has a reputation for marching the beat of his own drum, I guess you could say. He takes a different view of things. He often brings up a viewpoint outside of the kind of accepted or mainstream thought about what's believed to have happened. This is not the first time, and he's pushed various theories about how to address COVID-19 that aren't necessarily widely accepted in medical circles. This is in that vein. Now, the issue for him is, one, his poll numbers weren't great in the Marquette poll last week, or last year, I'm sorry. They were in the 30s. We saw a poll from a Democratic firm this week, which, you know, it's from a Democratic firm, take a grain of salt, but he was upside down by a pretty healthy margin among Wisconsin voters and how they view how he's doing his job. These kinds of things aren't necessarily helping him with swing voters. They may help the base, him with the base, and help get the base charged up, but he doesn't need just a base turnout election strategy in 2022. He's probably need some crossover votes or some moderate voters to get reelected. We don't know if Johnson's going to run. The signs are that he's maybe taking until spring, maybe even next year, before he pulls the trigger on what he's going to do. That's not making Mitch McConnell happy, because McConnell would like to know now where he's at, because that would help get the field situated, raise money, all that kind of good stuff. We also know Ron Johnson has not much use for Mitch McConnell. Go back to 2016, Nash Republicans really abandoned Ron Johnson to the very end of that race against Russ Feingold, and Johnson since then has been convinced that basically he doesn't need those guys and that his political instincts are more important than what consultants are telling him or what Mitch McConnell may have to say. Now, what's different about 22 are a couple of things. One, we don't know what a post-pandemic environment looks like. We've seen the party in front of the White House struggle mightily in Wisconsin for the last 16 years. But if the pandemic is kind of going away, if life is back to normal, if this COVID-19 bill passes, stimulus package passes, and the economy is booming next summer, that could be a whole different ballgame. We don't know. So there's that to watch. Two, remember Johnson promised to run for two terms. That was it. If he runs for a third, he'd be breaking that promise. And three, Republicans left John Johnson to his own in 2016, but Democrats also didn't really play here as heavily as they could have because they thought the race in the bag for Russ Feingold. That's not going to happen in 2022. whether it's Johnson or another Republican as a nominee, Democrats are going to invest in this race. It'll be a much different environment for him than it was back then. And every day he delays making a decision is less time to raise money. Now, he's got a pretty good-sized checkbook. He can write a check. The money will be there. But the money's going to be there on the Democratic side as well. And that's what I'm trying to make a point of, that people are kind of wondering, what's he going to do? So they can start to figure out the strategy of what this race is going to look like next fall.
Right, and on the Democratic side, we've got, three declared candidates now. Outagamie County exec Tom Nelson, Milwaukee Bucks executive Alex Lazary, and I believe a Wausau doctor, Jillian Bettino, and also a bunch of other names out there, too. Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, for one, State Treasurer Sarah Godlewski, Milwaukee Senator Chris Larson. Am I missing anyone, JR?
There's Steve Olicara, who is with the Millennial Project, Alex Lazary, the Bucks executive, trying to think. There are a lot of people kicking the tires right now. I get the impression that Sarah Godlewski will get in next sometime this spring. Barnes has got an interesting decision to make between running for lieutenant governor again or running for U.S. Senate. And it's going to become a question of where are the lanes for others to look at getting in. So I think it's going to be a fairly large field compared to, like, last time, at least, in 2012. And it's basically Tammy Baldwin had the field to herself. I'm just not sure who all is going to get in and pull the trigger in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well,
and if Johnson doesn't run, then Mike Gallagher, congressman from up in Green Bay, Sean Duffy, former congressman from Wausau, Kevin Nicholson, who ran for Senate in 2018. I mean, those are three names off the top of my head that I'm pretty sure would look at running. Ryan's previously mentioned as a run for governor, but he also could run for U.S. Senate. The names will be plentiful if Ron Johnson doesn't run for re-election in 2022.
Competitive elections ahead. Wisconsin teachers, school staff, and child care workers will be eligible for the COVID vaccine starting on Monday. The new vaccination phase coincides with an increase in doses the state is now getting from the federal government. In all, Wisconsin's getting more than 115,000 vaccine doses this week, which marks a 64% increase from the federal allotment in mid-January, when that level was around 70,000. State officials say they'll continue to advocate for more doses, and the increase will initially be targeted to educators and child care providers. Now let's hear from Department of Health Services Deputy Secretary Julie Willems-Van Dyke about how local officials will be allocating the vaccines once Phase 1B begins on Monday.
Right now, we've got an allocation of around 116,000, 120,000 doses per week. And throughout this whole last month that we've been vaccinating people 65 plus, we've been sending out about 70 to 80,000 doses a week. And we've gotten through half of the population with that allocation. So that allocation is still going out in our weekly survey to our vaccinators across the state. And we're saying, continue to focus on our 65 plus population as your primary focus with those 70 to 80,000 dose first doses. This is first doses, not total doses, first doses per week. And then we're taking the remainder of that, which right now is, around 30 to 40,000 doses, and we're putting that aside for teachers. And so that prioritization that you're questioning about is really happening in the upfront allocation, as much as it's happening on the by person in a clinic. So that's how we're addressing this.
DHS this week also announced it would open four additional community-based vaccination clinics over the next month, with exact locations to be announced in the coming weeks. JR, I want to get back to you with the topic of teacher vaccinations. There was a request from Waukesha County's executive this week that DHS consider giving priority for teacher vaccinations to those who are in the classroom in person rather than teaching virtually. Julie Willems-Van Dyke did say that that won't be used as a criteria, largely because schools have been sort of experimenting with hybrid models or fluctuating between in-person and virtual models. But do you expect to see more of a push to give districts give priority to districts in the coming weeks, either in terms of vaccinations or funding, for those that have been teaching in person over the last several months and plan to continue to do so over the course of this pandemic?
Yes, you also got to mention that Paul Farrell, Waukesha County Executive, is on my list of potential gubernatorial candidates in 2022, so can't forget that political piece to the policy he's pushing. That said, you know, look at what finance did. The finance committee did a couple weeks ago. So there's federal money coming in for schools. It's part of one of the COVID-19 bills. There's a smaller pot. So the big pot of the money from that is divvied up according to a formula based on how many kids in poverty you have in your district. All right, so that's kind of, you can't touch that. There's a smaller pot of money that would impact 172 school districts, and joint finance took that pot, smaller pot, and said if they're going to divvy it up based on how much you're actually in the classroom teaching kids. Now, the biggest school districts that are not doing or haven't been fully in person, Madison, Milwaukee, for example, they're not impacted by that. So it isn't really a huge carrot for the big districts because they can't earn more money. However, an example of what you're going to see, I think, in this budget coming up, because I've already seen Republicans complaining that Milwaukee, for example, got more like $220 million, I think, or more than that, this latest round of federal money, and they're not in person. While their districts, they argue, have been in person and have costs that Milwaukee hasn't had, how does that fare? Why I bring that up is, remember, we're going to have a school aid formula that divvies up the money. There's one pot of money divvied up according to, again, much like the federal money, of poverty levels, essentially. But there are other categorical aids you can do that aren't based on that, that can be specialized according to things like if you're in person. So what I'm watching is, how are they going to, the Republican lawmakers, when they, Finance Committee, how will they maybe tweak the formula to account for this? Maybe they're going to account for the federal money and say, hey, you got so much federal money that you don't need as much state money. It's really going to shape, I think, the school funding debate before the Finance Committee and the full legislature once they get that document in front of them.
Right, exactly. And we do face a July 1st deadline to get this budget enacted, but there's already been some talk that, you know, the first real deadline pressure we start feeling is in the fall when school districts have to start, you know, doing their accounts for state funding. But there's a question, I think, this year about whether that's enough of an incentive, I guess, to get a budget done if it does end up going that far out. I mean, I don't know if you want to say more about that, Jay, or make any predictions here, but...
Look, every budget I've covered... there's at least some chatter of, oh, they're never going to get it done. You know, there's always this tension of, oh, this is going to be this impossible task because it's, you know, they're so divided. They usually find a way to land the plane eventually. What I'm watching, though, with this one is, like you said, usually that October date is a pressure point. So in 2017, I think it was, Scott Walker's last budget, it dragged into September. Finally got it done then. It happened to be that I had my wife's birthday party, surprise 50th birthday party, but that's besides the point. But they got it done eventually. What I'm watching for this time is, do they feel that same pressure because all this federal money coming in for schools, might they say, hey, there's enough as it is right now, you guys can get by for a while. Because there's also another COVID bill, again, we talked about before with that UI extension, that's before Congress right now. I believe there is more money for schools in that bill. How's that gonna be divvied up? How's that gonna impact the debate? So again, it might add up to taking pressure off. Because remember, in Wisconsin, we're not like the federal government. If the budget's not done, we don't shut down. We keep going as is with current spending levels. And there are, quite frankly, some lawmakers I've talked to who are comfortable with that, who think, hey, you know, things are a little uncertain with this pandemic. Maybe we shouldn't be spending a lot more money. Maybe we spent too much in their minds last budget, and they'd be okay staying as is, especially that federal money coming in.
Lots to keep an eye on with this. We'll get to the last topic now. We're looking back on the November legislative races with the highest levels of spending by candidates, legislative committees, and third-party groups. In all, 14 legislative races cost more than $1 million last fall, according to the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, with three state Senate races logging in at over $2 million, SD32 in western Wisconsin, SD8 in southeastern Wisconsin, and SD30 in the Green Bay area. Two of those three races were for open seats, and they were viewed as potentially key picks up opportunities for Republicans. The other one, held by Senator Alberta Darling, was one Democrats were targeting. A bunch of other key seats on this list, two suburban Milwaukee assembly seats that Democrats ended up picking up, Wauwatosa Democrat Robin Vining's race for re-election, which she won, a bunch of other ones. JR, briefly here, any surprises in this list and any thoughts on the overall jump in spending we saw?
Oh, no, there are no surprises. And it was driven by the Democratic Party of Wisconsin being able to raise the money that it did. Chairman Ben Wickler, before becoming chairman, had been with MoveOn.org, had some national connections. You add in the national grassroots connections that Wisconsin was one of the key races of the presidential contest, and the Democratic Party had the governor's office again, it was a perfect storm to raise money. They did a great job with virtual fundraisers. The Princess Bride one, for example, got national attention where they had cast from that movie get back together and do a reading of the script. It kind of was the first of many of those kinds of fundraisers that Democrats did across the country. Wickler told me last week that they'll have next term for a chair at the summer convention. He is preparing for the next 2 years as if he has the opportunity to be in that office, i.e. he's going to run again. So he's got fundraising prowess that can bring money in, and we would again be in the eye of the storm with the Senate race, the top of the ticket, plus the governor's race. So there's a chance to raise money again. You could see some records broken again. It's just unique that usually we see Republicans outspend Democrats. This time, Democrats had more money, but money doesn't always make a difference. The nature of the district, the candidates, those kinds of things. I mean, they spent a ton of money as Robin Voss, and he won by 18 points, not 21 points, 2 years ago. So money can't solve everything in politics, but it does drive the conversation and get you attention. I expect a lot of attention in Wisconsin in 2022.
And that's all we've got time for. Thanks so much for watching this week's show. I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And that's Rewind for February 26th.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.